In Sarah Dunant's new novel, we first meet Sister Lucretia as the nuns in her Tuscan convent are preparing her body for burial. They discover a tattoo, a serpent, which slithers from her shoulder down toward her most private of places. Before Sister Lucretia took holy orders, she was a vibrant Florentine woman with a talent for painting. Her name was Alessandra Cecchi, and Sarah Dunant tells her life story in the historical novel The Birth of Venus. Sarah Dunant is in the studio. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Leanne.
Alessandra Cecchi is 14 years old when you begin her story. She's the daughter of a wealthy fabric merchant with a beautiful sister that's about to get married. In some way, her story kind of the ugly duckling story, that kind of tall, precocious adolescent who doesn't really fit in to her society, which in this case is 15th century Florence?
Well, I suspect by definition, if you were a young woman in that time and you really wanted to paint, you were going to have trouble, actually. Florence was the most vibrant, flamboyant, confident place. They were rediscovering Greek and Roman classical civilization. They just found a new way to paint, which put men on the wall next to God in flesh and blood. And one of the things I wanted to do was try and give an impression of what it was like to live at this moment of history, as if everything around you was modern and exploding and exciting. And of course, one of the things that's missing from Renaissance history is the eyes and the voices of young women. There is no Shakespeare's sister. There is no Michelangelo's sister. And it wasn't my intention to write a novel about discovering a Renaissance painter that we didn't know who was a woman. But it was my intention to say, what would have happened to a young woman with dynamism and determination and intelligence and talent had she tried to somehow make her mark and get her fingers to move to the walls and make pictures on them?
Why was painting your choice for Alessandra's ambition?
Because painting was such a powerful definition of what the Renaissance meant. You know, I cannot tell you the difference that took place once artists learnt how to recreate the human body in flesh and blood in three dimensions. When you go into the churches in Florence, before the Renaissance, you see rather beautiful, rather aesthetic, two-dimensional pictures of very big Christs with halos and tiny little ordinary people right next to them, just to show what the hierarchy was. Once these artists get to manage human flesh and to find, with a little help from Plato and the Greeks, a sense of humanism, you walk into churches and you see the birth of John the Baptist and his story. But actually, John the Baptist appears to have been born in a 15th century palazzo, looking as if it's come out of house and garden. And the people who are visiting on the birth, well, my goodness, isn't that Mrs. So-and-so whose father commissioned the painting? It's almost as if, I don't know what, George Bush commissioned a mural for the Oval Office of the Resurrection, and at the bottom you'd see a picture of Condoleezza Rice and, you know, Conan Powell, and they'd all be there recognizable because they were part of the patrons. Mm. That's what happened at this moment. Art was not just art, it was power.
I'd like you to read from chapter 28. Here, Alessandra has been married off to an older man who turns out not only to be a homosexual, but his lover is her brother. And there's a scene where she says, if I cannot have the love of my husband, I have alchemy. And this gets into her, the very sensual nature, I think, of what being able to paint means to her. It's on page 223.
Okay. Outside, the ice melted and turned to spring as I cooked up a feast of colors, my fingers growing callous with grinding and dark with paint stains. There was so much to learn. My maid, Arila, helped me, measuring and mixing the powders and preparing the surface of the wood. Nobody bothered us. Around us the house ran itself, and if there was gossip, then it was surely no more damning than for the sins already at large. It took me the best part of 5 weeks to transfer my enunciation onto the wood panel. My life became absorbed in the swirling folds of Our Lady's skirt. No lapis paint still, but a fine enough shade of blue mixed from indigo and white lead. The deep ochres of the floor tiles and a gold-leaf halo for my Gabriel in luminous contrast to the dark surround of the window frame beyond. At first my hand was much less steady with the brushes than with the pen, and my clumsiness made me despair at times. But little by little my confidence grew, enough so that by the time it was finished I wanted immediately to start again. And in this way, I forgot the pain and madness of my brother and my husband, and healed myself.
This is a very pivotal moment, not just in art history, where perspective is being developed, as you said, but politically. It's that change between the Medicis and Savonarola, who comes in, who's a rather reactionary friar, and you recreate in one of your scenes Bonfire of Vanities, where Savonarola says, bring all your gewgaws and we're going to burn them. It was art, was this idea of the sensual almost a way to hold on to who they were?
It is such a particular and yet universal moment, this, when liberalism and liberal thought finds itself in a head-on collision with fundamentalism. Savonarola, this religious, ascetic, demagogic, very powerful, charismatic monk, looks at the Renaissance and, not without some justification, says, you're reading all this stuff, these Greek and Roman philosophers. They're pagans. They lived before Christ. They are burning in hell as you speak. And then he looks at the walls of the churches with these pictures of man standing right next to the saints, dressed beautifully and with their flesh shining out. And he says, and once we start to take our eye off God and to put our eye on human flesh, then the devil comes in. The theocracy which he brings into power doesn't allow gambling, it doesn't allow dancing. Women aren't allowed to wear rich clothes anymore. They have to go out in public with veils on their faces. They can't always go to church because sometimes Savonarola will preach about politics and the state is men's business, not women's business. When I was writing it, I didn't really think about it, but it has so many echoes of what happens when a religion becomes fundamentalist, when it cannot deal with the pleasures of sensuality as well as the facts and the laws. And in that way, I think it's a universal story as well as a particular one. Luckily, Savonarola also tries to take on the Pope. And faced with that power struggle, Savonarola loses. And he goes to the stake and Florence returns. And in a sense, the Renaissance wins. But there's elements of Savonarola that I have some sympathy with. He's right. Once you do stop painting God and you start painting man, something shifts. Botticelli's Birth of Venus is a beautiful, young, chaste, naked woman. Take it 50 years down the line and Titian paints Venus of Urbino, and it's a naked prostitute lying on the bed, staring straight out at you, saying, hi, got anything I can help you with? You know, he puts his finger on something. It's unstoppable, but there is some truth in it.
You are known for mysteries that you've written, some thrillers. You do radio work for the BBC. I mean, what was it that finally got you to sit down and write this?
I absolutely think I fell in love with this city. I found myself there one summer. I had 2 weeks before my teenage daughters arrived, and I sat there with a pile of books and a map, and I just fell into Renaissance history. And by the end of the 2 weeks, I thought, I have to write about this. And then fate just played into my lap because my two teenage daughters arrived. One was just 10 and the other one was 13. And the 13-year-old, who was like attitude on a stick, took one look at the city and said, and I swear these were actually her words, I think you should know, Mum, that at this time in my life, I don't do culture, I just do shopping. And the 10-year-old, whose whole raison d'etre was to pretend not to be the 13-year-old, said, I think it all looks very beautiful, Mum. Can we go and look at some pictures? And so I walked through the city with these two vibrant young women next to me. And while I was listening to them, that's when I thought, wait a minute, the one voice I haven't been hearing here is the voice of women. And it was a great liberation, which I think if you choose to write in history, you have to have at some point a feeling of, we didn't know this, I am going to imagine it. That's the power I get as the novelist. I'll get the facts right, but I also have the power of my imagination.
Sarah Dunant's new historical novel is called The Birth of Venus. It's published by Random House. Sarah, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Leanne.